ਤੁਸੀਂ ਹੋ SBS ਪੰਜਾਬੀ ਦੇ ਨਾਲ।
SBS Radio।
Alan Touch, welcome to SBS Punjabi. Pleasure to have you back.
Thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, how are you coping with Melbourne's Stage 4 restrictions, especially as you've just come back from Canberra and you're probably in mandatory quarantine?
I am. I'm just finishing up my quarantine, actually, and then heading back to Canberra on Friday, and we'll be up there for the rest of the year. But, I mean, the situation is pretty desperate here in Melbourne. We've been in lockdown for such a long period of time, and I hope that the Premier will announce the reopening of the economy on Sunday, even though the case numbers still maintain that higher level. But you know what? They're at a similar level to New South Wales. And New South Wales is open, the businesses are thriving, the people aren't wearing masks, people are going to the beaches. And if New South Wales can do it, why can't we do it in Victoria?
But for you and personally for your family, how does it feel coping with the restrictions as such?
Oh, it's never about me as a politician. It's always about the community, Mandarin. But my family is like any other family, and we have our own stresses on us, particularly with kids not going to school and the like, and the additional stress that puts on everybody, and childcare not being available until just recently. So that, of course, creates stress on everybody. I actually really feel and am very conscious in Victoria about the impact on mental health of young people in particular, because they can't connect up with their friends in a normal manner. And well, it's not just young people, but the mental health impacts are enormous on all Victorians through this. And I think that's sometimes not fully appreciated by the state government. That's why I really hope that we can get out of those restrictions soon so that people can get back to a normal life, reconnect with their loved ones, go and visit their elderly relatives, young people go and catch up with their friends again and try to get back to a normal life.
You actually touch upon a very important topic that has been close to the heart of a lot of people who are stranded overseas. So I think they are reflecting all of these emotions and much more. And I'm talking about Australian citizens and permanent residents who are stuck overseas. So they have the added disadvantage of not being able to fly back home to Australia for months together, not being able to resume their normal lives. And the highest proportion of these 10,000 were people in India alone. And they've not been able to come back to Australia due to the pandemic. So why hasn't the federal government done any more to help these people out? I mean, so many people have told us that they feel completely ignored and abandoned by the government.
Yeah, so, I mean, we really feel for those people who are stuck overseas and still can't make it back to Australia just yet. Now, all of this has come about, of course, because we closed the borders back in March, and it was probably the most important thing that we did to get control of the pandemic. But it means that since that time, the numbers coming into the country have been very small, and we only have certain quarantine slots available each week, and they're run by the states, and so people have to effectively try to get one of those slots, and the airlines effectively manage themselves towards those quarantine slots.
With due respect, Minister, why can't Australia as a government send mercy flights when you know that thousands and thousands of your citizens are stranded in a country? The only option they have is to try and fly the national carrier of the country that they're stranded in this case, Air India, with very, very limited number of seats. I mean, we saw a flight go down to South America when the cruise ship, landed there, and we repatriated some of our countrymen and women then. Why have these people been left in limbo for months together? Why no flights from Qantas?
The issue is not always the lack of flights. Now, I don't know about every particular location in India, but certainly we've been working with the airlines to ensure that there are airlines available and flights available. The issue and the bottleneck typically is actually the quarantine arrangements back in Australia. And the airlines will only put on the number of flights to fit that quarantine capacity. Now, Melbourne is obviously has huge number of Indians here in Melbourne, and we presently have not a single quarantine bed open in Melbourne. Consequently, there are no international flights coming into Melbourne at the moment because the Victorian government has no confidence in running a quarantine system. Now, New South Wales has about 2,000 slots available each and every week, and we're putting pressure on the other states to open up their quarantine arrangements. Once those open up, then the airlines will put on more flights to be able to meet the opportunities for those quarantine arrangements. So that is as big a factor as any in terms of people being still overseas and not being able to get back into the country. And we're putting pressure on those state governments to lift their quarantine bed capacities so that those Australians can get back.
So these are Australians, and for all intents and purposes, they've not been flown back for months together. Are you comfortable with that? Is that a good message to send out to the world that it's okay, we can let our citizens be?
There's about 20, the last time I looked, there was about 20,000 Australians who are still trying to get back into the country. And our quarantine capacity is just under 6,000 beds per week. So you can quickly do the maths and work out that most people will have the opportunity to get back relatively soon. Now, in the case of those Australians who are in India, as I said, I don't know the situation with all of the airports in India. There was a time there when the Indian government closed down all the international airports. Now, I know that they have opened up in most cases again, but I don't know, and I haven't got the data in front of me in terms of how many flights there are between, say, Mumbai or New Delhi, back to Sydney, for example, on a weekly basis.
They're all Air India flights, Minister, I can tell you that. There's none being operated by anybody else. India actually has travel bubbles with countries like the USA, and there's free flights coming, you know, to and fro. People are travelling. It's just Australians who are stranded, and somehow the Australian government has done nothing to get our own citizens back.
Well, again, I wouldn't say we've done nothing. In fact, we've worked very closely with the airlines to ensure that the airlines will have flights available to get Australians back. And it sounds as if, and I don't look after either the transport or the borders, so I'm not the responsible minister for this, but I do know that the government as a whole has been working very closely with the airlines to try to ensure that there are flights available for people. Now, if you're telling me that there's just insufficient capacity on the flights from, say, Mumbai or New Delhi or wherever in India, back to Australia, if that's the issue, then that's absolutely something I'm very prepared to take up.
Minister, that's been the issue for months. That's been the issue for months because the Air India flights come out, people book them. They're pretty much booked within the first few seconds of when the seats become available. And then even if someone's lucky enough to get a flight, they can be cancelled. There have been people who've booked and rebooked their flights three or four times. They're out of pocket by thousands of dollars. And months on, I mean, this is not as if we're in the first month of the pandemic. And that is the whole question, that this has gone on. This is month seven or month eight into the pandemic, and still people who belong to this country, who are citizens of this country and are permanent residents, who have their livelihoods here, cannot come back.
Well, as I said, we've been working with the airlines to ensure that they are putting on aircraft to most places in the world. Part of the challenge is going to be that there are no international flights coming to Melbourne. And there's no international flights coming into Melbourne, which is obviously a very large source of the Australian Indian population, because there's no quarantine bed capacity here in Melbourne. There is in Sydney, and so no doubt those flights are going into Sydney. As I said, I don't look after that portfolio area, so I'm sorry that I'm not across the detail here. No. I look after the visa programs, and Minister McCormack and Peter Dutton look after the airlines and the border controls, respectively, but I'm more than happy to take this up.
Sure. Let's talk about the visa program. Now, the budget came up with news, you know, I'll just focus on a couple of things that have resonated a lot with the community. First of all, the general skilled migration program have been slashed quite heavily in the current financial year. The other news that really is a big setback, especially for people of the Indian community, is that English language test for partners being sponsored by permanent residents. So this has never happened before. And I know that you're seeking a functional level of English, but when I look at the definition on the Department of Home Affairs website, people coming from United Kingdom, USA, Canada, New Zealand, Ireland have an automatic waiver. If you're coming from those countries, you don't need the test. This is a huge disadvantage for prospective migrants from India, especially knowing full well that it is the largest cohort of skilled migration into the country. What do you have to say? What was the rationale behind this?
Well, first up, if you are a skilled migrant, then you already have to pass an English language test. And it's more than functional level. It's actually a higher level than that in order to be eligible for that skilled visa. What we're talking about here is the partner visas, correct. Which is basically, yep. So the first point is that we already have an English language test, and it applies to Indians, as you know, for the skilled stream. And as you point out, Indians make up a very large proportion of that skilled stream, and they do so very successfully. This applies to the family stream, and the largest proportion of the family stream is indeed the partner stream. That's specifically what it's applying to. And who this applies to is that when you are already here in the country, so you've already got to the country and you're applying for your permanent residency visa, and typically that will be at least 2 or 3 years before you get to that stage, we are asking the applicant to make reasonable efforts to learn English. And what we mean by reasonable efforts, in most cases, will be undertaking the free English language classes. That's how we define it. And if a person has undertaken those free English language classes and made every effort to do them, then regardless of their level of English, they will satisfy that criteria. Now, you don't have to do those classes if you already have English levels at a functional level. But if your English isn't at a functional level, we just want you to have a crack. We want you to make that effort, because I tell you what, if you don't have reasonable English in Australia, your chances of getting work are minuscule. Only 13% of people with no English in Australia are in a job. Only 13%. And moreover, it is so difficult in Australia to fully participate in our society if you don't have at least a basic level of English. So it's in the migrant's interests, as much as it's in the society's interests, for everybody to at least have that basic level of English. And hence we're putting on this requirement that a person makes a reasonable effort to learn the language.
Minister, post-Second World War, when we had a huge cohort of migration from Europe, we know that a lot of people didn't have the English language skills, even much later, you know, after the Vietnam War and all of that, we've had a lot of migrants come in and become successful businessmen and women and establish themselves and become good Australians. Why this thought now, which actively discourages someone who may not have the skill, or even if they try, they may not be up to scratch? What if they have, you know, children and they are unable to attend the classes to that level of 500 hours as required? Aren't you actively saying that if you don't have English skills, you're not welcome in Australia?
No, absolutely not. In fact, as I said, the person comes into Australia to start with. So you don't have to have any English to come into Australia, and you'll be on that temporary visa to begin with. And it's actually after 2 or 3 years, when you're applying for that permanent residency partner visa, is when we'll be seeking the evidence that you've made the reasonable efforts to learn English. Now, I deliberately use that word reasonable efforts because it will have a bit of flexibility taking into account if people have exceptional circumstances that they really struggle for whatever reason to be able to attend classes. Now, if they're in an accident, for example, then clearly that gets taken into account. And we'll be documenting these guidelines, and it won't come into effect until late next year, so we have a bit of time here. But we just want people to make that reasonable effort. Now, you mentioned employment and the fact that when people came in the 1950s, many didn't have English and many went straight from the boat straight into a job, and you are right. But the employment market is very different today compared to what it was in the 1950s. In the 1950s, you didn't necessarily have to have English to be able to do an entry-level job. Today, you almost certainly do, because not least of which the occupational health and safety requirements today require you to be able to read basic signage, require you to be able to communicate with people. And hence, the data is so compelling today. As I said, if you don't have English today, only 13% without English today are in a job. Only 13%. Let that figure sink in. So effectively, if you don't have English, you'll be going onto the dole.
Minister, you know that partners cannot go on the dole. We're talking about partners over here, right? And we're also talking about...
But once it's a permanent residency visa that we're talking about, once you have permanent residency, you have access to Medicare, you have access to Centrelink, you have access to all of the benefits which all permanent residents and Australians have.
And only if the partner can demonstrate that they can look after this dependent of theirs who they are sponsoring. So the dole doesn't even come up. My question really is that the Home Affairs website clearly says for applicants from the United Kingdom, USA, Canada, New Zealand and Ireland, they don't have to take this English test. So there's a waiver for them. What does this mean to prospective migrants from India or people who have partners back home in India? It's quite common, as you'd be aware, a lot of permanent migrants over here go back home to India to get married. What happens to them? So they should not be doing that? They should ensure that somebody has adequate English language skills before they're able to even get married to someone?
No, I mean, you're being ridiculous here because I've been through this. You can go over, you can get married. That person will be able to come out here on a temporary visa. But while they're out here for those first 2 or 3 years, before they are then eligible to apply for that permanent partner visa, which is what we're talking about, in that 2 or 3 years that they are here in Australia with their partner, before they apply for that permanent residency visa, we ask them to make reasonable efforts to learn English. And that means take advantage of the free classes that the Australian government provides, paid for by other Australians. And why is that? Because it's in their interests, as much as it's in our society's interests, for there to be a common language. Because if you don't have a common language, how do you maintain social cohesion? How do you have a conversation nationally if there isn't a single common language? Now, it's great that people speak multiple languages. Don't get me wrong. It's an absolute asset, and we encourage people to. But equally, English is the common language which we share and the common language which we communicate with each other on.
You would have heard Christina Keneally say this is racist and discriminatory. People have, you know, told us at SBS Punjabi, it almost seems like Australia is now discouraging migration from non-English speaking countries or countries where English may not be as high a level. And with respect, given Australia's past of the Wide Australia policy, where a dictation test was necessary to enter or re-enter the country, are we really going back to our past?
Well, again, I think those comments are ridiculous, and to suggest that this is racist is offensive. I mean, Manpreet, we already have an English language test on our skilled migration program. And as you point out, Indians are typically the number one source, the number one group of people that come in on those visas.
But if they can't sponsor their partners...
The Chinese are often second. Typically, the Indian and the Chinese are the number one and two of that skilled program, which already requires an English language test, but actually a hard and fast test for the primary applicant. So we've had this in place for some time. But to suggest that this is somehow racist is also suggesting that Susan Jin, the former president of the Chinese Association of Victoria, is supporting a racist policy. That Vasan Srinivasan, the president of the Australian Indian Federation, is supporting a racist policy. That Hastalal, one of the Muslim leaders, is supporting a racist policy. That Maha Abdo, the president of the Muslim Women's Association, is supporting a racist policy. That Bon Nguyen, the president of the Vietnamese Association of Australia, is supporting a racist policy. Is that what you're saying? All of these people are supporting a racist policy? Because I think that's a very big accusation in relation to both myself and indeed to those people who support this policy, because they know that it's in their community members' interest for them to make an effort to learn English.
With respect, Minister, what I'm putting to you that this is a huge disadvantage to prospective partners migrating from countries like India. And this hasn't been there for a long time. This is brand new, that the language requirement has just come in. So this hasn't been there forever. This is a new thing that during the budget process, we realized that this was happening. And that's why the question.
But it only requires a person, once they are in Australia, to make a reasonable effort to learn English, and that is to take advantage of the free English language classes. That's what it's asking for in order to be eligible to become a permanent resident. And once you're a permanent resident, of course, then you have access to all of the benefits which other permanent residents and citizens have in Australia. And so through the government, the rest of the Australian public is saying, we are going to welcome you here to Australia with open arms. But we expect you to make that reasonable effort to integrate into Australia, and that includes making a reasonable effort, having crack at learning English. It, of course, means that you need to stay out of trouble from the law and not commit crimes, otherwise you would put yourself in jeopardy, that your national security record is clean, and that you fit the other criteria attached to a particular visa. That's what's required, and then once you meet those hurdles, just like the millions of other migrants, you'll be welcomed into the centre of Australian life. And that's been the Australian way. And our whole country has been built on migration, and it will continue to be built on migration once the pandemic is over.
So you can reassure prospective migrants that they will not be discriminated against on the basis of their English level skills?
Well, I can reassure every single applicant that if they make a reasonable effort to do the free English language classes available to them, they will meet that hurdle with flying colours.
Minister, time's running away. I've got a few very quick questions to ask you as well. The net migration will be negative for this year and next year. Can Australia, as a society which has been built, as you rightly say, on migration for years and generations, sustain this, knowing that we are an ageing population? What's your prognosis for the short term and the long term?
Well, we are forecasting that this year and next year, the net overseas migration will be negative for the first time in 75 years. And what I mean by that is that there'll be more people leaving the country than coming into the country. And that is purely because we closed the borders and we now have limited migration coming in. Why did we do that? Because of the pandemic. And if we had not done that, I don't think we would have got control. In fact, I know we would not have got control of the virus. And unfortunately, while Australia has managed very successfully the pandemic and largely got control of the virus in nearly all jurisdictions, many other countries around the world have not. And the cases are in the hundreds of thousands, or if not the millions. And so we're still going to have quite strict border controls for some time, until there is either a global vaccine or until we have bubble arrangements in place with individual countries where people are able to move freely between the two countries. So it's going to be difficult, and that has big economic consequences for Australia when we have a low migration rate. And you point out one of those, that it means that we age. It means we don't have population growth that we used to, which is a driver of our GDP growth. And we need to make up for it in other ways. And that's what our budget tries to do. It tries to make up for it by try to encourage further business investments, try to boost our workforce participation so that we can still maintain that the economic growth that we've been used to.
Surely the lack of a migration and also the fertility rate is, you know, not being right up there would hurt the economy in the long term. Can I also ask you about the future of the international education industry? I know it's not your portfolio, but the borders are closed. What is the prognosis there? You in the federal government, how do you see that panning out? Because we're hearing from a lot of international students that they might be going, say, Canada and other countries because they've been left high and dry as well.
Again, it's a function of the borders being closed or with limited migration. And international students have been very good for Australia. They've been good for our economy, and they've been good for our society because many international students stay and become fantastic citizens. We hope to get that market up and running again in the not too distant future. And
can you put a time?
Soon at least. We can't put a time on it at this stage. We want to get some trials up and running soon. And I think, you know, but for the quarantine failures in Victoria, I think we would have actually had those pilots up and running by now. But Victoria, which is actually the biggest source of international students of all jurisdictions, doesn't have any quarantine beds at the moment. So nobody's coming into Victoria. No international students, no migrants, no Australian citizens are flying into Victoria.
But
they're flying into other jurisdictions.
Yeah, students are not coming to New South Wales and the other places too. It's
no,
only Northern Territory and
not,
South Australia.
But yeah. They're not. But my point is that all other jurisdictions then got nervous about their quarantine arrangements because of Victoria and therefore reduced their capacity. Now, you reduce the quarantine capacity, it means you reduce the opportunities for Australian citizens, for students, for other migrants to come in. And we have to get those that quarantine capacity up and running again. And we'll be relying upon that unless there is a vaccine which becomes globally available.
Just to round off the interview, Minister, and you've been very generous with your time, I do appreciate it, but just to round it off in the end, your message specifically to prospective migrants from India who are looking at this from the outside, who are seeing that the general skilled migration program for this year has been slashed, who are also seeing that for partners a new language test has come in, are there any words of reassurance that you have for them?
Well, I think your description is not an accurate one about our migration program. I think that a fair description of Australia's migration program is that we have been, and we again will be, one of the great migration destination countries in the world and the greatest multicultural country in the world, and will always have open arms to people who want to come to Australia, share our values and make a contribution. And we've done that so successfully in the past, and we'll do that again in the future.
Your message to temporary migrants, we didn't talk about it earlier, but there are a lot of temporary migrants who've not been able to re-enter the country and who've been forced to exit the country due to the pandemic, especially those who are waiting to arrive, who may have received their visas but are unable to travel and are in limbo. Should they be waiting? What should they do?
Again, we're faced with exactly the same situation that I've been describing with the quarantine arrangements. That becomes the bottleneck for all inward flow of people into Australia. Whether they're Australian citizens, international students, permanent residents, or other temporary visa holders. There's only so many quarantine slots available in each jurisdiction, and zero in Victoria. And so the broader that we can make that bottleneck by having more quarantine beds available, the more opportunities there will be for people to come into Australia, and the speedier it will be. And of course, the federal government is putting some pressure on the state governments to increase their quarantine bed capacity. But ultimately, the state governments are the ones that are in charge of that. And so I think you ought to have a conversation with some of the state governments as well, Manpreet, about their quarantine bed capacity, because that becomes the bottleneck for all of these groups of people that you're referring to.
And very finally, Minister, those citizens and permanent residents of Australia who are stranded overseas, and like we said, majority of them in India, any words of assurance to them?
We understand the difficulty that they are under. We absolutely do. And we want to ensure that they can get back to Australia as quickly as possible, particularly for those citizens and those permanent residents. But the pandemic is causing great grief, great economic harm, great social harm right across the world. And we're working through that. And we want to get Australians home as quickly as possible.
Minister, you've been very generous with your time. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Manpreet.
SBS.
This is SBS Radio.
ਕੀ ਤੁਸੀਂ ਇਸ ਤਰ੍ਹਾਂ ਦੀਆਂ ਹੋਰ ਪੇਸ਼ਕਾਰੀਆਂ ਸੁਣਨਾ ਪਸੰਦ ਕਰੋਗੇ?
Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify या जित्थों भी तुसी अपने podcast सुनते हो।